Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So US inflation is now running at 4.2% on an annual basis, according to the CPI for April. Producer prices have been rising the world over as the input costs for production creep up. But we're told by central banks that all of this is just temporary. Inflation may kick above the level that they're happy with, the level at which they would normally, when inflation gets too high, start pushing up their interest rates. Because almost every central bank is saying that inflation that we're seeing at the moment is only transitory. So does that mean companies were pushing up their prices now will pull them back down again later? When does that ever happen? So is it transitory? And if it is, what follows? Less inflation or perhaps deflation, which is something that analysts were talking about before the pandemic hit? We'll look at all of that today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. So it's interesting, isn't it, how the US, Steve, is seeing inflation creeping up, even though they've got 8 million people who were in work before the pandemic who are not working now. So, I mean, you can, and obviously the circumstances are accentuating this time, aren't they? Because it is, this inflation is largely driven because of supply chain difficulties. But it shows you can have creeping inflation without reaching anywhere near full employment. You can have quite a high level of unemployment, but still see inflation kicking in.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very unusual experience. Yeah. I mean, let's frame it properly. This is the first time we've actually had a recession that was caused by a shock to the economy, which is almost a reason for the neoclassicals to break out the champagne, because that's what they think everything is caused by, shocks to the economy. Well, here's a shock. But What comes out of that is a large amount of supply chain disruption, which is something we haven't ever had as a major issue in any previous outbreak of inflation, like, for example, the 1980s. When you go back to the 1970s to the early 1980s, that was before America began to en masse ship its production facilities offshore to the third world to take advantage of low wages. China didn't enter that game until 81, 82. So you didn't have the same capacity to shock the supply chain back then that you have this time around. And then when you do it, what it means is suddenly stuff just isn't available. And so the normal expectation economists have is, we'll cut the supply, price will rise, you know, intersecting supply and demand serve stuff. But in reality, this tends to have an aggregate demand impact as well. And if you have economy which has got very sluggish demand, and you hit it with something like that, then you have suddenly what you get coming out of it potentially is a drop in consumption, not an increase in price. So the supply side price shock can come in. For example, I believe lumber has gone up dramatically in America.
Yeah.
Okay.
So something like 12 or 13% increase in the cost of building a house because of the increase in the price of wood in the United States.
Yeah, which is huge. Mm. Yeah. Now what the question then is, well, what's the flow-through effect of that? So if you're in a booming economy, when people are borrowing hand over fist, go and build those houses so they can get them to flip that house game, then they'll go take out additional credit to finance that increase in the cost of materials. And that additional credit turns up as part of aggregate demand in the economy as well. And out of the two, you will get a flow through of that increase in supply price. There'll be an increase in wages coming out of it as well. That will again come back and both kick up prices, but also kick up aggregate demand. And you get a demand-driven follow-through from that initial supply shortage disturbance.
So is that what's happening now then, do you think? Because we're coming...
No.
We are seeing demand increase because we're all coming out of, out of the crisis in various parts of the world, and people are getting back to work and they can shop where they couldn't before. And, you know, so this supply chain disruption is pushing prices up because the demand has increased.
There's a touch of that there, but the touch is going to be attenuated by the inability of anybody to turn that dipping into their pocket into dipping into the bank credit. Because again, I mean, looking at the data, it hasn't been the household sector that's borrowed money during the pandemic. The level of household debt to GDP has risen, not because households have borrowed more money, but because GDP has fallen. So the denominator has fallen, the ratio rises. But corporates have taken on a large amount of additional debt, largely because I think they've had to do that to be able to maintain solvency and meet their commitments by extending their credit lines. But then they're not going to keep on doing it. So the flow through that means that an initial supply shock, which we're seeing now, and initial additional spending, because yes, people are coming out of being, you know, having to live as hermits for the last year and a half, and the other spending to celebrate not being hermits anymore. But the sustainability of that out of cash flows is limited. If you want to keep it going, then given the level of debt people in, they've got to borrow more, and they're not going to borrow more. So I just don't think the stimulus overall is going to be there to sustain that level of price rise.
Well, they're going to have to push their prices up, aren't they? I mean, even, you know, ignoring these supply chain issues, if you've got a lot of companies that have borrowed to survive, then, and they have to recoup that money because they can't borrow forever, and, you know, and they're not going to see full demand for a while yet, I don't think, then they're going to have to push their prices up to try and pay back some of that debt, aren't they?
Yeah, but then the question is just how effectively can they do it at the aggregate level? So, I mean, if you're individual, yes, you're going to, you put your prices up. What's going to be the impact of that on you? Now, if you have the booming economy we had back at the end of the 60s, which is when inflation first took off. So if you look at the data, the real takeoff to inflation between still very low in 69, I think 71, 72, 73, it began to really expand. So the 71 to 75 period is where you see the big jump in inflation initially, with at the same time an enormous credit bubble going on globally. So that's your initial boost. So in that world, when you put your individual prices up because you have to, then the money is created by the new credit coming into the economy to enable that to be sustained over time. But when you have what's happening now, you're not going to have that sustained capability. And this is where thinking about it in terms of the actual cost structure of firms becomes important, because in neoclassical textbooks, the higher the supply, the higher the price of production. Their models have a rising supply curve, so you have to pay more. If you want to get more of something produced, you've got to pay a higher price for it. That's all based on the idea of what they call diminishing marginal productivity. So to produce more output, you've got to hire more workers working the same amount of machinery. Their productivity goes down, and therefore the amount being produced goes down relatively. You get more of an increase in cost than you get an increase in output, and that puts your prices up. In the real world, firms face declining marginal cost. So rather than the firm having a rising levels of marginal cost causing its prices to rise, it actually, if it can expand output, it has
as demand increases,
cost of production.
And in
that world, your markup rises, your margin will rise without you doing anything about it because your per unit costs are falling.
Yeah.
That's the real world.
Yeah, the real world, which everyone would understand that. You know, does it cost you more per unit to create 1 million of something versus creating 20 of them? Obviously, it's a lot cheaper to create a million. And if the demand is there, then you're going to sell that million and you're going to be able to charge less for them. But this point about people being in debt, companies being, corporations being in debt and wanting to pay it back, they obviously, that the money they've borrowed is new money. From commercial banks, it's new money being created by commercial banks. So the money supply is increased. If at the same time, we've got governments creating money and spending, so that's more money being increased. So the money supply, the M2, however you want to measure it, the money supply it has increased hugely through this crisis by the combination of corporate borrowing and governments. So governments are going to want to cut back on spending. Those corporations are going to want to cut back on borrowing. So the money supply, as they pay it back, is going to start shrinking, isn't it? So that would, you could argue, would be deflationary rather than inflationary.
That's what I think is going to happen, yeah. Mm. Because if we had the conditions of the late 60s and early 70s, and you had this price shock coming through, and in a sense, what we're talking about now is an extreme version of OPEC, which actually happened back in 73.
Mm.
So in the OPEC price rise after the Yom Kippur War, the Arab states put a blockade on sales to America, which increased the price of oil from $2.50 a barrel to $10 in 1 year. And now, in that situation, because there was already a boom going on at the same time, there was an increase in the money supply because banks, firms would access their lines of credit to pay that additional cost rather than paying down their own cash reserves. And workers also, because it was a booming economy, demanded wage rises to make up for the higher price cost of gas, and you got an inflationary surge which was sustained. Mm. But this time round, because you know there's just not that, you're not going to go, you want to reduce your level of debt now, you don't want to increase it. So that price rise will cause the prices to rise, margins to fall, but then there won't be a continuation of that demand. And I think we'll see it going from initial supply-driven price rise into effectively a credit negative credit deflationary experience, and you won't get that sustained rise in prices.
Right, which is actually, I mean, they're not predicting deflation, but the Fed is, I mean, they'd be very concerned, wouldn't they, if they were listening to this, but they are saying, yeah, the inflation that we're seeing, and of course, you know, they had the CPI numbers out of the United States there the other week, which surprised people because it was a lot higher than anticipated. We'd seen producer prices, you know, the input prices increasing, so we knew it was coming through the supply chain. Now we're seeing it in the CPI figures and the inflation figures in the United States. We're not seeing it quite so much anywhere else in the world just yet. But the Fed is saying, oh, this is just shocks to the supply chain. It's temporary. It's going to go away. Don't worry your pretty little head about it. And they're probably right on that.
They could be right. I mean, we are in completely uncharted waters from now on, because we're going to start seeing climate change effects coming through as well. For example, Taiwan has a drought right now. You aware of that?
No.
Okay, Taiwan has a serious
drought. I watch the BBC. They don't tell us. They just tell us what's happening in the rest of the world. Who knows?
Okay, well, Taiwan is having a serious drought, and Taiwan produces a serious proportion of the world's integrated circuits, something of the order of 80 to 90% of integrated circuits come out of Taiwan. Mm. Water is an essential input, enormous scales of water for the production process involved in semiconductor plants.
No, I knew we had a big chip shortage. I didn't realize the root cause of it.
That's the cause. It's right. Drought in Taiwan, which is climate change cause. Now, in that world, I've got a little personal reminder. My son-in-law put together my new, relatively new desktop machine for me about 2 or 3 months ago. And he now tells me that the graphics, because this is also Bitcoin caused, by the way. Mm. So Bitcoin is causing inflation. Because the graphical processor units, GPUs, are used to do the numerical calculations involved in mining Bitcoin, the cost of the video card in my computer is now $2,000, which is more than the cost of the whole computer when it was bought 3 months ago. Now, that's a nice little cameo of what we're talking about here. But that'll happen because people think I'm making a bomb out of mining Bitcoin right now.
Mm.
So that then justifies them borrowing the money to go and buy the GPU to be able to add more processor cycles to get closer to winning the nonce award. But if you don't have that in general, then people stop buying PCs.
Yeah.
And you get a collapse in demand instead.
Well, so it does level itself out on that basis, doesn't it? And that was going to be my other question as to whether inflation actually is a bit self-correcting. I mean, I hate to talk about equilibrium because I know how much you hate that word. But, I mean, whenever we peak, so we peaked in the UK at 4.2% in 2008, but it quickly fell. It peaked in 2011 at 5.1%, but then it fell quickly after that. And even in 2017... You know, it only reached 3.1%, but then it started to slide again. It doesn't seem to stay, you know. And even, go back to 1990, you know, it got up to 8.2%. We did have a long period of, you know, well over a year, like 30 months or so of consecutive months of inflation over 5%. But then after that, you know, it subdued. And, of course, it's never been back up to those levels since. So isn't it a bit self-correcting? You know, it's if prices get, I mean, you know, from a non-economic point of view, prices get too high, people stop buying stuff. So prices have to come down again.
Well, there's a little problem there that that's not supposed to happen in neoclassical theory. The price adjustment is supposed to be independent of effects on the real world. In fact, what we're talking about is where the real world kiboshes an increase in prices because you're knocking demand out of the economy courtesy of the price rise.
Yes.
It's actually, I've got a...
Why would neoclassic economists have a problem with that? That's just...
Because they want to argue what they call money, the absence of money illusion. And so we don't actually think in terms of the absolute prices of goods. We think in the relative prices, and money prices are relevant. Now, if we start saying that changing the money price has effects on the real world, we're out of the neoclassical universe.
Right. So if the price of cars goes up, then we'll look at the price of chocolate biscuits and say, oh, well, look, chocolate biscuits have gone up too. Therefore, I can afford that car because everything's gone up, even though my salary might not have gone up. But, I mean, the reality.
Too much real world. Sorry, yeah. Too much real world. No, they'll just basically they want to say that all you're doing by changing prices is changing relative attractiveness of different commodities. You're not having an impact on aggregates. So the absence of money illusion, quote unquote, is an essential part of the foundation of neoclassical general equilibrium models. Back to my favorite word again. So they don't want to admit that your changes to interest rates or inflation might work through a real economy mechanism where if, you know, there's a massive decline in spending caused by the increase in prices, or the economy is stimulated by an increase in prices. They just don't want to know about that.
So they would see that the fact that your computer that cost you £2,000 or $2,000 now might cost $4,000 or $3,000, and you might not have bought it on that basis. They don't see that. They just see that you'd fork out the extra cash.
The desirability of computers has gone up compared to the desirability of pigs. It's costing me more pigs to buy the computer I'm using. They'd leave out the price dynamics.
Right. But, I mean, there's affordability question here, isn't there? You know, it's like, can you actually afford to be able to buy?
The real world again for a while.
Yeah, I know. Because in this real world, I'm also looking at, you know, if we're told that inflation is temporary and the Fed is telling us that and we're seeing prices creep up, my response would be, now's a really bad time to buy something that's expensive. I don't want to buy a car if prices are going up this year, but the Fed is telling me this is temporary and inflation won't be around next year. Then I'll wait for my salary to increase a little bit with this rising inflation. And then when prices level off, then I'll buy. Why would I buy something if it's getting more expensive?
Yeah, and also, I mean, if you don't have the cash flow to support it,
you
know, if you actually do have a constrained spending power because you're not going to go and enhance it by borrowing money at the time, then your response to a price rise is going to be a fall in demand. And this is what I think is feasible to happen after initial inflationary surge caused by the increase in supply costs, by supply chain disruption, both by COVID and climate change. Once it comes through, its impact will be a decline in demand after the initial increase in prices. And for firms, this is one reason I talked about the shape of the cost curves that firms actually face. Their cost curves are falling. The higher they produce, the lower their unit costs. So we have an increase in volume. You actually get an increase in your margin, even without trying to achieve that. Now, if you get forced in the opposite direction, if demand is falling, your per unit costs rise. And if you can't pass that on as a price rise itself, your margin falls. And therefore, you have a decline in margin. You're going to have a decline in investment. So this is the part of the way that actually does lead to a very severe real-world effect. And that's why I'm still expecting a deflationary outcome out of this inflationary surge.
So the Bitcoin Brigade, you know, the Max Keisers of this world, who argued that, you know, you should buy Bitcoin, well, first of all, because he's got some, so it'll help him out. But also, I'm sure there's more to it than that, Max. But also, I mean, the argument that's given is that, you know, there's too much fiat money. You know, we're expanding the money supply too much. That's devaluing the pound or the dollar. So buy Bitcoin because it's got scarcity on its side. So that, and that's, you know, why we're seeing Bitcoin increase so much. They would argue while we're seeing the money supply increase. But if we are going to see the Fed buying less, the government starting to pull back, corporate loans decreasing, then that, by that same argument, Bitcoin should come down in value, shouldn't it? Because its comparative advantage disappears, doesn't it? Because you know, because there's not quite so much fiat money now.
Yeah, well, that's the story they tell. I mean, that's another, that's a whole new different fantasy regime to neoclassical economics, of course. But yeah, that's the story they're telling. I mean, it hasn't been a good week for them on that front.
Well, last week wasn't. Yeah, exactly. But they see themselves as a substitute to gold, don't they? But if they're a substitute for gold, why not just buy gold?
They are a substitute for gold if you're a dragon that likes sitting on the stuff in Middle Earth.
Yeah.
Because that's what you do with it. You sit on it. You don't let it get spent. That's where this wonderful expression hodl comes from. And again, the trouble with the Bitcoin mob, from my point of view, is they believe that money should not change in value. Now, there are some non-orthodox economists like Soddy who argued for that you should have a stable value for money. But fundamentally, that's focusing on the store of value side of money when the essential thing for money in a capitalist economy is means of payment.
Yeah.
And if you have something which is appreciating as fast as Bitcoin can and which has a whole philosophy of hold on for dear life to it, you're not going to use it for consumption. So it's not money.
No.
And that's why I find the whole argument.
But it's also
one. Even though there's been fortunes made out of it, it ain't money.
Yeah, because if you look at a currency like the pound, for example, well, you know, what's the productive power that sits behind it? It's the productive power of the UK economy, isn't it? The pound represents the economy that it represents. Whereas Bitcoin has nothing of any value sitting behind it. I mean, the only value you could associate it with it is the power that was used to create it. Otherwise, it's got no underlying intrinsic value. So
yeah,
I just don't get why. Why is always my question on Bitcoin. Just why? You don't have an answer to that one. You're speechless at last. But what? Anyway, so but why? How? Why is it causing inflation then? Just take me back to that as to what the effect. Just it's going up in value. Why is
Bitcoin,
that? Why is that?
Then,
yeah. Why is that causing inflation in the wider economy?
Particular case, not a large deal. It's a particular piece of computer hardware. You need a graphics processor unit to do the numerical calculations to solve the sequence of zeros that gives you the
You made the point that Bitcoin was adding to inflation currently.
Just for that mechanism, because VGA card, like the card in my computer, if I wanted to sell the card in my computer now, I could get more than I paid for the computer for it.
So the demand for processing power is getting being created by the Bitcoiners, which is pushing up the price of computers being used for productive purposes, for example, like
podcasts,
or trying to find solutions to a virus, for example, that might be ravaging the world as well. You know, all that sort of stuff. So where does Friedman fit into all of this then? Because he this gets back to the amount of money in circulation argument, doesn't it? You know, the old money, the amount of money and the velocity of money basically determines the price level. Well, so it's MV equals PT, isn't it? So the amount of money, the velocity of money equals P, which is the price level, which is inflation, and T, which is the value of how much we spend. So he managed to simplify that equation, didn't he, by saying, well, the velocity is constant, probably the value of expenditures as well, so the amount of money basically equals inflation.
That's what he did, yeah.
But that's not what happened. It's happened now, for example.
And it's also that money is not only created by the Federal Reserve's helicopters, it's created by private banks. Would you like a loan with that marketing at the teller? It is something which, his logic blamed the helicopters for causing the inflation. In fact, it's the banking sector. But the banking sector has been taken out of the equation by their success in driving up our borrowing over the last 40 years. And therefore, all you've got left is the helicopters. And now you've got a government deciding to go in the opposite direction. So
has his theory been proven wrong then, or this M vehicle?
Oh, totally.
Added a lot of extra money. So M has, doubled or whatever. But we haven't seen prices double, and it's completely disproven.
Yeah, but that won't keep some people believing it, because it gives you this nice little neutralized vision of the economy. That economy works fine. It's just the central bank and the treasury that are to blame, and that is such a part of the ideology of economics. People will never wake up to the fact that monetarism failed. I mean, the interesting thing, I've reread recently Friedman's papers on monetarism and the Federal Reserve's reactions to it. And he actually wrote this article for school students in the Journal of Economics Education. This is Milton Friedman. And he complained that the money supply was nowhere near as stable as it should have been after monetarism was practiced. And he was really disturbed by that. Blaming the Federal Reserve for not having a steady enough handle on the tiller. But in fact, it was the hand in the till that was the matter. That was the banks. And in his model, banks didn't create money, but in the real world, they did. And therefore, the volatility of money was far higher than Friedman thought would be the case after bringing in monetarism. And ultimately, everybody was disappointed by the monetarist experience, including Friedman.
Mm. So this period of inflation we're going to go through right now could actually slow down our recovery, couldn't it? So because it will delay expenditure. So this bounce back that everyone's expecting with this money we've all supposedly got sitting in our bank accounts waiting to be spent, if we're told that inflation is coming, well, if we're told inflation is coming, it hasn't got here yet, then we might rush out and buy stuff in a bit of a hurry. But then when prices start to rise, I don't know about you, but I'm always looking for that 20% off sticker, and if it's not there, I don't buy it. So that's going to delay the recovery. I mean, if we had that fictional money sitting in our bank account, which I don't think most people do, we might be more keen to save it. And plus, we're more cautious these days, obviously, as well. So
we have to be. So I can just see that the aggregate demand follow through that's necessary to turn a supply shock into sustained inflation is not there. So I think what we're seeing, rather than people spending, as you say, they're going to decide not to spend. And therefore, it's going to be the increase in prices causing a fall in aggregate demand at some point, not the increase in prices causing a continuing increase in prices with a sustained level of aggregate demand underlying it.
Which is a bit of a shame, because actually for those corporations that have borrowed, a bit of inflation would be a good thing, wouldn't it?
Well,
if it didn't impact demand for their goods, but in terms of paying off their loan, obviously it would devalue their loan over time.
Well, that's what actually happened. When you look back at the 70s and 80s, what happened then was you had such a high level of inflation that on occasions, even when you were paying interest rates of 17%, that was a negative real rate, because the inflation rate was running at 19 and 20%. So at that period, it did reduce there was a fall in the real debt burden, even though debt continued to rise. And the reason was the monetary value of GDP was rising faster than the outstanding monetary value of debt. And that's what gave you a revival. And that's actually, neoclassicals like to believe there's no Keynesian explanation for stagflation. But it was written by Minsky before the period actually appeared. And that was an argument that if you have a booming economy before you go into a slump, and the 60s, the 70s was a classic big boom in the economy, then a slump afterwards, then if inflation occurs in that environment, you have a decline in the level of investment. So the economy is growing more slowly because there has been a slump and people investing less. So the economy is growing more slowly. But the momentum of price inflation is still coming through. The positive feedback from price rises causing more price rises in adjustments down the line. And that will mean that, therefore, the monetary value of debt remains fairly constant because people aren't borrowing, but the monetary value of GDP increases because of the increase in the price level. You'll have a fall in the debt burden, and that will then trigger another boom. And that was the explanation that Minsky gave for stagflation before stagflation actually happened.
So what about this argument that we're going to see wage inflation? And I think there's two arguments here. One is that companies in America are saying that they are having difficulty recruiting people, even though there's 8 million people still out of work who had a job before. And you could say, well, that's because they're the wrong jobs or the wrong people. Take your pick. But, you know, we've seen a restructuring of the economy. So people have been trained in the wrong things or don't have the skills. And so that's that. So companies are having to pay more to get the right people to switch to their companies. And then there's another argument, which is being given by some Republicans, that the state aid, which is being offered, the extra money, is it $600 per fortnight or whatever it is, which is being added on top of your unemployment benefit, is dissuading people from actually going back to work because they can't make that much more money. So companies are having to pay more to get over the benefits which are being provided by the government. And that could create inflation because it's going to create wage pressures.
Yeah, I mean, there are parts of the American economy where that makes sense, but it's because those parts of the economy are so sick. Mm. One of those little cameos that stuck in my mind forever was I was in a conference in Florida with a whole bunch of fairly religious people at a conference organized by, memory for names has gone out the window. But anyway.
God.
God, that'll do. Yeah. A local representative. And we went out for dinner. And the bill came around and it included, it suggested 20% gratuity.
Yeah.
And these are a lot of people from the third world, and they were objecting to having to pay another 20% on top of the written bill. And I said, look, you have to pay it, because if you don't, the waiters and waitresses here get nothing. And one of them came, a young woman quite articulate, probably a university student, I imagine, came over and said, excuse me, I couldn't help but overhear your conversation. Our pay rate without tips is $2.37 per hour.
Mm.
Okay. So in that world, I mean, restaurateurs are complaining they can't get staff to work as waiters. Well, no surprise, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the wage you're offering is so low and the dependence on tips is so high that if you get a decent level of labor, you're not going to be working in a restaurant.
Yeah. There's a whole different scenario, isn't it, in the United States,
yeah,
where
yeah.
actually they may get a bit of rebalancing coming out of all of this, where people are actually demanding.
Yeah, they need it.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact that the legal way, I think it's still the case, the legal pay rate for the restaurant, for waiters in a restaurant in America, I think is still $2.37.
It's calculated
$3 an hour.
I know. Well, it's calculated based on getting that 20% tip, isn't it? That's how it's calculated.
The minimum wage, the risk of capitalism to the workers.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's a shocker, absolutely. So inflation, you think, and the inflation that we're going to see this year then and perhaps into next year as well is going to be temporary then. The first thing you've ever agreed with the Fed on. And it's probably going to be very much limited to specific industries and product types, isn't it? Because it is all going to be supply chain driven. It's going to be supply chain disruption. If there's no supply chain disruption, then there's no reason why prices would rise, because everybody is going to be fighting for the demand from consumers.
That's basically, you're not putting up the prices unless you have no choice, because there's some increase in your supply chain that if you don't pass it on, you go bankrupt.
Yeah.
So that's the potential. And then the question is, what happens to the demand for that economy, for that market segment? So we'll soon see. If there's nothing independent like Bitcoin pushing it up, then the demand will fall.
Yeah. And then we're back to where we were before, which is very low inflation for a long period of time. I mean, we've not seen inflation over 5% since 1990, really. So is that the norm now? What's going to ever bring back inflation?
Yeah, well, I think it is the norm because, I mean, this is why I'm doing a bit of simple mathematical logic on what actually drives inflation. You find ultimately that I'll use equilibrium here as just a balancing point. The equilibrium price level is the money wage divided by the output per worker. And where the denominator is the output per worker and the inverse of the markup that firms put on their commodities. So if you have a rise in the markup, that will cause a rise in prices. Now the markup is not going to rise; it's going to fall. So that's deflationary. Money wages aren't going up, so that's deflationary. Then you have output per worker. If that goes up, then it goes down, then you're going to have potential inflation coming out of it. All of them argue for a slump and not for sustained price rises after this supply shock.
Mm. All right. Well, there we are. We'll leave it there for now. It's good to talk again, Steve. Okay. Catch you again next time.
Okay. Thank
you.
Okay, bye.
And we forget, don't we? Before all of this started, we were looking and wondering, where is inflation? Are we going to see deflation? That's been off the agenda for the last year and a half, but how quickly will it come back again? We'll see, won't we? That's it for today. That's the Debunking Economics podcast. Back with another one next week. I'm Phil Dobby with Steve Keen. See you then. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.